For the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at some of the stories from the book of Judges. The time of the Judges is an interim period between the death of Joshua, a very short time when leadership was by a group of elders, and the later rule of the kings. The judges were a disparate group of leaders, and we should keep in mind that the modern sense of a judge is not what we have in mind here. They were rulers as well as adjudicators, chieftains as well as vindicators. Another thing to keep in mind is that the collection of writing from about this period comes from much later. There's inevitably a process of interpreting of events handed down through the generations in the light of the latter kingdoms that dominated so much of Israelite history. There is evidence throughout Judges of building a case for the later kings alongside the wider sense that God is at work in the history of his people. The book of Judges follows a repeated pattern depicting the Israelites falling into wickedness and evil, a time of punishment under the rule of another, their salvation by one of the judges, and then a period of relative peace before the cycle repeats again. For modern ears too, the sheer bloodthirstiness of these narratives can sometimes be a little bit overwhelming. This week's judge is Deborah. The name means bee, and you cannot but imagine Deborah as the queen bee at the centre of activity within the Israelite hive. Deborah was Israel's only female judge. According to Frederick Buchner, she looked like Golda Meir, the modern state of Israel's fourth and first woman prime minister, and she did her business under a palm tree. Her business consisted of more than just stepping in and settling things when people got into a wrangle. Like all the other judges of Israel, she was loaded with charisma, and whenever there was any fighting to be done, she was the one who was in charge. Even generals jumped when she snapped her fingers, and Barak was just one. She summoned him to the palm tree and told him she wanted him to take 10,000 of his best men and beat the stuffing out of the Canaanite forces under a general named Sisera. Barak said he'd do it, but indicated he'd feel more secure if Deborah went along. She said she would. And she said it was also only fair to warn him, however, that the main glory of the day was not going to be his, but a woman's, because a woman was going to be the one to wipe out Sisera. And her prediction turned out to be correct, of course. Barak won the battle, but Sisera was disposed of by a lady named Yael in a rather spectacular way. And to make sure that Yael got all the credit that was coming to her, Deborah wrote a song to help spread the word around. And we heard a little of that song. It's a wonderful song full of blood and thunder with a lot of hair-raising bitter jibes at the end about how Sisera's old mother sits waiting at the window for her son to come home, not knowing that Yael has already made mincemeat of him. Deborah composed it, but she gets Barak to sing it with her. And Barak, according to Buchner, looks like Moshe Dayan, the former defense minister of Israel and contemporary of Golda Meir. It must have been quite a duet. The song brushes by Barak's role rather hastily, but it describes Yael in lavish detail and must have gotten her all the glory a girl could possibly want. And Yahweh gets a plug at the end, but by and large, the real hero of Deborah's story is herself. Everything was going to pot, the lyrics say. The towns of Israel stood abandoned. Deborah, they stood empty until you came like a mother for Israel. You can't help feeling that Deborah's basic message was that mother was the one who really saved the day. And of course, with Yahweh's help, she was. Deborah was an extraordinary woman. When completing my divinity degree, my dissertation looked at the impact of two women on their respective churches, St. Catherine of Siena and Katharina Schutzel, the wife of one of the early reformers of the church in Strasbourg. Both were women who took up roles which were countercultural at the time. Catherine, a young woman, a medieval mystic, who spent her life dedicated to Jesus and fighting for the Pope to return from Avignon to Rome, where she believed he belonged. Katharina, on the death of her husband, continued his ministry by preaching and by conducting funerals. Both swimming against a tide, speaking out when women were hardly listened to, both leading when women were rarely in leadership. And as well as being activists, they were both prolific writers, and yet very little of what they wrote remains in the public domain. When I considered their impact, their legacy, I was dismayed to find that in reality, they had no long-lasting impact on the way the church regarded women, particularly in leadership. For their time and during their lifetime, yes, they were important, but long-term, their stories remain mostly unknown. And if you think about our own denomination, it took until 1968 for the first women to be ordained as ministers of word and sacrament. Today's women ministers owe a huge amount to the women like our friend Jean Montgomery for their strength and determination. And it's fair to say true acceptance and equality has still not been achieved. My dissertation also looked at how women in the Bible were reported and regarded. There are many more women mentioned in the Bible than you might think. But still, only 5% of the people who get a mention are women. Some suggest there are as many as 137 distinct women who get a mention, but that's compared to over 3,000 men. The answer is to say, well, that's no surprise then. The world of ancient Israel was patriarchal, and those who put down on paper the words of the Old and New Testaments were men from that patriarchal world, and would have seen nothing unusual about that. Then this leaves me wondering about the women like Deborah who do get a mention. What extraordinary women they must have been that the male writers thought their stories so important to still include them. Let's think a little bit more about Deborah. What was so extraordinary about her that her story is included in the narrative of the Book of Judges? She's not only a political leader, she's also a military leader, devising campaign strategy, and the military under her command are hesitant to go into battle without her presence, particularly against a large, well-equipped army. Her presence, symbolic of God's presence, means the oppressing army of Sisera were routed. Not included in our first reading, but worth noting, is another woman who enters the story. She gets a brief mention in that second reading, Yael from Sisera, the enemy commander. And he goes to Yael and seeks sanctuary. And she lulls him into a false sense of security, and she does him away with him with a tent peg, hammering it into his skull. This was no simple random violence and breaking of hospitality ethic, for Yael's husband was in a pact with the oppressor, King Jabin. And so Yael takes it upon herself to break with her husband's pact in order to bring about justice for she, as the name suggests, her name suggests by her actions. Yahweh is God. Deborah's song mentions Yael, giving another woman praise and place in Israel's story. Deborah and Yael, both strong women, women who acted, women who both got a mention in our Bibles. These women were not silenced. Such was their importance. The silencing of people is not something that's restricted to the patriarchal writers of the Bible. Today we still silence people. Think of the churches that have no women elders, let alone being willing to countenance women ministers. And last night at the film night, we watched a fantastic movie, Hidden Figures. It's based on the true story of three friends, women of colour who worked at NASA during the early years of the space race. Bright, intelligent women who, by dint of colour and sex, become hidden figures in the story of history of space, written out and ignored, despite the huge influence they were. Katherine Johnson, one of the women, was a child prodigy in mathematics, and she became key to the space race by outcomputing the earliest IBM computers and working out trajectories and landing spots for the first rockets to put an American in space. Catherine's story in the film shows how, despite her genius, she faces discrimination, not just for being a woman, but for being a woman of colour. The film highlights the difficulties faced by people of colour during the 1960s. Segregation in all areas of their life, from the toilets at work, to the libraries, to schools and the drinking fountains and the buses. The film is both heartwarming and heart-wrenching to watch, the outright injustice of it all. And yet the women persevered and eventually won people over. But still their stories were never told until now. They were, in effect, written out and silenced. But it's not just women or people of colour. We silence others. Children, young people, the poor, those who are different to us, the ill of mind and body. We silence them by ignoring them, refusing to get involved in their lives, not listening to their views, thinking for them, doing things for them instead of with them. There's a slogan, "Nothing about us without us," used by many groups seeking their voices to be heard. I first heard this phrase when involved in the Church and Society Council. It was an often quoted phrase that the convener would use to remind us when thinking about the many issues people face in their day-to-day lives. That unless we listened to the voices of those whom our work was focused on, then what we had to say had little integrity or value. People living in poverty are the experts in knowing what they need. But how often can we be guilty of thinking we know best and we have all the solutions? Young people are the experts about what they want to do with their time. But how often are we guilty of saying this is it, like it, or lump it? Similarly, with people facing physical or mental health challenges, others make decisions about what they think are solutions without thinking first to talk to those living through these difficulties. International aid is one area where the rich nations have been guilty for a long time of imposing solutions on those poor people, providing sticking plaster treatment rather than working with communities to provide long-term solutions. So one of the reasons I like what Christian Aid does so much, the work they do overseas is all about working with local people to help them become the solution to their own problems. Most definitely living out the nothing about us without us. The danger we have in trying to solve all the solutions to the world's problems is that in our eagerness to help, we do things to people rather than with them. God proves time and time again in his story that the solution can be found in people we choose ordinarily to ignore. God uses the most unexpected people. Not everyone is the archetypal hero. Indeed, very few are. Even the big and strong have characteristics that remind us that they were all imperfect people, and yet welcomed into God's story and made use of. Rick Morley, in reflecting on our reading this morning, wrote this. He said, "God does wondrous things by calling upon people, people like Moses and Deborah, people like you and me. Sometimes God calls upon the elderly, like Abraham and Sarah. Sometimes God calls upon the morally compromised, like David and Paul. Sometimes God calls on young women, like Mary. And sometimes he calls upon ancient female judges sitting underneath a palm tree. And God sets things in motion," he writes, "great things, wondrous things, with us and for us." God needed help, and he went to Deborah, a woman sitting under a palm tree. Whilst others would have walked on by, he found who he was looking for, who he needed, and he used her. A reminder again of God using the most unexpected of people. And he still does that today. When he uses you and I and reminds us not to discount the possibilities to be found in other people. God's story is not finished. We are all playing our part, all of us offering something to the narrative. None of us should be silenced or written out of the story. In God's storybook, we each have our own chapter still being written, and it's an exciting tale. Maybe not on the epic scale of Deborah, but exciting all the same because it is our chapter being written by our God who loves us. I was telling someone this week that one of the real privileges of ministry is being able to listen to people's stories, finding extraordinary in the self-deprecating, self-described ordinary. Learning about the person behind the face that we meet is always fascinating and always a privilege. Each of us is extraordinary in the eyes of God. Our chapter in his book, precious beyond measure. And not just us, each of God's precious children. People of colour, children, young people, the poor, those who are different to us, all the ill of mind and body. Each story a story worth telling. Each story interwoven in God's story of love. Amen.